Hello there. We are the Brothers Geek, and this is our podcast. My name is Patrick Schmaltz.
New year, same idiots.
New year, same idiots.
Of course. Why would we change?
Why would we change?
In year what, like seven or eight of this shit?
There's no, yeah, we are who we are. You two are colossal idiots. I am not.
Clearly.
Also true. My name is Patrick Schmaltz. I am one of the three Brothers Geek. With my other brother, Christopher. Hello, Christopher.
Happy New Year! Hello, everyone. This is Chris Schmaltz.
Do you prefer Chris or Christopher? I don't think I've ever asked you that.
Yeah, honestly, that is a question that I have too. Are you like, when you're at work, are you Christopher or are you like Chris?
Everything is signed Christopher.
Okay.
But everything else is Chris is fine. But if I'm like the signature on my email, Christopher Schmaltz. The signature on letters I send out, Christopher Schmaltz. Yes.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
All right. On paper, you're Christopher.
Paper and email. Email the signature block in my email. Yep.
Digital
but like
paper.
Your coworkers, they know you as Christopher.
Chris.
They call you Chris.
Oh, okay. They call him Chris. Yeah.
And then my other brother, Andrew. Hello, Andrew. Have you ever gone by Andy, Andrew?
Andy.
I was
no.
Andy
no.
I was Andy for a
it
little
hurts
while.
My, it hurts my ears, dude.
It hurts me. It hurts
yes.
me.
I have never ever thought of you as an Andy. Like, seriously, that is so weird, but it's true. You are 100% Andrew, 100% of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I tried to be an Andy just because I wanted to do something different. Like in grade school, I was probably like 9 or 10. I was like, I'll try Andy this year. I don't
Andy.
Know. Our grandmother, Grandma
didn't
Fern,
take.
She called me Andy.
Oh,
she did.
She would address birthday cards to me, Andy, for a while.
Oh, so,
but she was like the only one. But yeah, it was Andy. For Grandma Fern called me Andy every now and again, but
Grandma
yeah,
Fern.
No, I'm Andrew or
Gigi.
Gigi, yeah, I'm Andrew to everybody.
Great grandma, yeah.
And my previous job, my job that I have now, I've been there a year, but I still don't have like you know a close group of friends for many reasons at my job because you know I don't work with anyone in close proximity because we're working at home. I was Schmaltz at work a lot. People called me Schmaltz.
I'm Schmaltzy.
I get that too.
Oh, yeah?
Schmaltz? I'm Schmaltzy.
Well,
yeah.
Because
and yeah,
I would like to discuss this, and this comes up in movies
yes.
a lot. Is
yeah,
the,
yeah.
Is the Schmaltz? What it, you know the
yes?
Like, are you full of the Schmaltz? And because it's like a word in the English language,
yeah,
I think that people just like. It comes out of people's mouths easily. It's like calling us corny, which we all are. It's just like like we're all in our DNA.
Unctuously, yeah.
Yeah, we're all like emotional corny dudes because of our father. It's like
right.
His name is Schmaltz, and then we.
But our mother, I mean, mom is pretty earnest too, dude. Mom is pretty earnest.
Yep. Excess. I mean, it's so funny to think about how. The definition, English definition of Schmaltz is excessive sentimentality. And if doesn't define dad.
100%.
I mean,
exactly.
It is
our father.
It is all of us. But dad is like the paragon of this. It's so funny to think that that's how we are.
It really has worked out that way for us.
Well, there's this whole like idea.
And we love him for it, by the way.
100%.
There's this psychological theory. I think it's like I'm gonna blank on the name. Like it's some. I always think of it starts with like Sapir Whorf or something like that. Is that what it's called? Where it's like English shapes your thoughts. Like your language shapes your thoughts. It's like a It's a psychological sort.
Yeah,
like,
that rings a bell. I don't remember
how you structure your language shapes how you think about the world. Mm-hmm. And dad was just born, and they were like, oh, your name is Schmaltz? Well, now you have to be the corniest, most emotional,
most
like
earnest.
Earnest.
Yeah. Sentimental, yeah.
Every time you talk about something, you have to cry. Like,
lots of crying.
You literally have, I mean, and I
good
mean,
crying.
Father,
good, lots good of crying.
Good crying.
Our father means everything he says 100% of the time. He means it. You can trust everything that dad says.
That's
100%. An absolute statement from himself. He doesn't fuck around at all.
Doesn't fuck around at all.
But he raised four boys who give each other tons of shit. It is a direct reaction to our father meaning every single thing he's ever
his sarcasm switch is genuinely off, right? There's very little sarcasm. Occasionally it flutters when we like goad him into it, right? He occasionally busts out, but for the most part his sarcasm switch is absolutely off.
Yep, very much so. I mean, he understands sarcasm.
He remains a super sharp guy, but
super sharp.
Oh, no, he does not. Yeah, he just doesn't.
He doesn't have the time for it. He doesn't have the time for it anymore. So yeah,
there are times where he just like he realizes that you're messing with him, and he just is like,
yep.
He just can't.
I'm making the face of like, yeah, you're making the face down, and he's just like, he's like, all right. And he just accepts his fate. This is episode number 158. We're recording this on January 11th. Okay, big disclaimer. We're probably going to talk about other things, but the big topic of today's episode is The Expanse. The Expanse is on Amazon Prime, if you didn't know. It's a great science fiction show. We've been watching it since season one. Some of us have read many books of this series. I've read all of them. Yes. Yeah, but these two are more knowledgeable than I about the books. We're talking about, at this point, we've had 6 episodes. They're releasing weekly. And so we wanted to do this sooner, but like holidays and other things coming in the way, we're now going to talk about episode 1 through 6. Hopefully not too long windedly, but you know us.
You know those two guys. They are prone to syndroming. I will keep my thoughts into short, very concise sentences.
Very concise. Yeah.
Very. But those two.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Christopher's thoughts tend to be like they tend to be very machine gun like in their staccato nature.
That's it. Yeah, machine gun like.
Short bursts of that 50 cal so it doesn't heat up too much. That's how Christopher encounters every conversation.
That's his nickname.
He's
that's
like, right. I'm gonna hit you with some big rounds.
I'm like Hemingway, they're like James Joyce.
Wow.
I'm more lyrical like I don't know F. Scott Fitzgerald, so
that okay. Joke is too over my head, too literature wise.
Come on, art guy, what the hell?
I'm into art, not literature. Come on.
Literature is art. Are we going to discuss that? Are we going to argue that? Let's do that. Let's go.
let's really put our audience to sleep. Let's do that. Let's do deepest dive possible.
Oh my God, perfect, Andrew. Okay. They released episode 1 through 3. It was a great setup for the season. Right out of the gate. Here we are.
Back in the solar system. We've returned to the solar system from last season.
Season 4 mostly took place on that planet, and Holden and the crew dealing with the other planet stuff.
That's right.
So now we're back in the solar system. We see the state of things in season 5. They mention Marco and Aros in season 4 a little bit too.
Season 4 we meet Marco and Aros, and he's like a rogue agent in the belt.
Uh-huh,
like one of the power players in the belt.
Right.
He is
a new player because he is not a prominent player through the first 4 seasons. That's Fred Johnson and what's the other name of the other guy?
Yeah, what's the other guy's name?
Anderson Dawes.
Anderson Dawes.
Anderson Dawes, right? Well, those two are the power players.
He hasn't been in a couple of seasons either. Did that actor just not want to come back for the Prime stuff?
You know, I don't remember. Anderson Dawes showed up a little bit. Obviously, the actor.
Or is he dead? French. He's alive, right?
Anderson Dawes? I feel like Anderson Dawes is still alive.
He's got to come back. Anyway, he's got to come back.
The point is, the villain, quote-unquote villain, for this season,
That's part of the discussion. Is he the villain?
Is he the villain? The antagonist.
Discuss. Yeah.
The antagonist for this season was not a power player previously, and he shows up and he establishes himself. Like he kicks the door down into the room, and he's like, "This is now." He becomes maybe. I mean, we're not spoiling very much by saying it. Through the course of the first few episodes, he becomes the most dangerous person in the system.
Well, yep. the first shot is of the number 9 asteroid getting blown up into the Earth or in the sun, and you're like, what is going on? I didn't know. I hadn't read the books that far, so I didn't know what.
When you read that, how that's all kind of like built up.
Oh my god,
it's fantastic.
Yeah,
what I love about Marco Inaros and the book is definitely coloring my opinion of him as well. Because I'll be honest, the actor who plays Marco, I did not have that image in my head of who Marco Inaros was. He's almost too handsome and like almost too young. I pictured him as older. And
I agree.
More impressive, but this guy definitely has like.
I had him as like the stereotypical, like, you know, middle aged, you know, a little gray in his hair, but, you know, a very chiseled jaw. So they caught some of that. But this actor is too young for my image.
Speaking of weird age things, like how old is Philip supposed to be and how old is Naomi supposed to be? Because she doesn't look like she's old enough to have Philip.
Well, I agree with that. In the books, we're embracing a reality of this universe where people in the belt age differently because they grow up outside of radiation fields. They grow up in low gravity. So Philip, I think appropriately, is uncharacteristically tall for a teenager. He's definitely a teenager, but in the book, he's like 15 when the story starts.
Yeah, that actor is like 18. Yeah,
Nineteen, early 20s in that range.
Especially because if he's like 15 and smoking fools, because he is, he kills people in the first episode. He kills unarmed civilian scientists, Earth scientists who find pieces of the rock.
That's what I was getting into, but the whole discussion about Marco Inaros, how he's like the new most dangerous power player in this system, the Expanse, he is a true, and his scheme and how it all comes together, it is true supervillain shit.
Yeah,
like the elaborateness of his scheme, the consequences of what he's doing, it is true supervillain shit.
But it's not arch.
It's not like he's twisting his mustache.
Right.
Or he's that kind of like he is a lark. And I think that we get this from the book too. And Chris, you're alluding to it. His presence is so huge in the books that having an actor play him on the show even diminishes it a little bit, maybe in my mind. But he is true supervillain shit. And the show pulls that off really, really well. This is a mastermind, and it definitely comes off that way.
That's my comment to that, and my feedback on that is that supervillain has this sort of comic booky, not really realistic sort of connotation to it.
That's how large his scheme is. It's supervillain large.
Well, and so what impresses me about how they wrote him in the books. And you get a little bit of that, but less so in the show, is that the dude is a freaking mastermind. He is a demagogue.
Yes.
True demagogue and the smartest person in the room at all times. And that sort of in the books, it comes across. This is my take on this. The book comes across a lot clearer that the dude is like, everybody else is overmatched when they're confronting him. Whereas in the show, he's just kind of a insurrectionist, right? And you get a lot more flavor for that from the books in terms of all of the levers he is pulling and just the decision making that he goes through to pull off the most devastating attack on the Earth in human history, right? And so there's a little bit less gravitas in the character on the show than definitely my impression of him in the books. And so that's the only miss so far in terms of they could have and they should have written him a little bit with more gravitas. Like, he's a true leader. Everyone around him believes in the cause, right?
And they defer to him.
Right.
You get the feeling of that, like these guys, the crew
members, they love and respect.
Besides Philip, they have like those couple of like crew members that I'm not really sure what their names are. Maybe you know their name, but the random crew member number one and random crew member number two that are like following him around, that love him, that like believe in the cause, but like the cause that Naomi points out to Philip is, you just have like helped out a mass murderer, killed millions and civilians, not just like unarmed civilians, families, random people, because of what you believe in. Like, and Chris, I think you asked the question of like, is he the villain? Like, I mean, that sort of dispels it out, is like, this guy's willing to kill civilians to do his cause, and I feel like that is the difference between
I agree with you in that sense, Patrick, that I mean he's inflicting his will on people who have never directly wronged him or the it's a flaw of the show because it doesn't go into that, it can't just the storytelling medium, it can't go into that much depth. The books, you get a lot better sense of just how oppressed the Belt has been and the Belters have been for the past 100 years since the creation of the Epstein Drive, and travel to the outer planets has been economical and easy, and you know they could do it quickly. The books really gives you the sense of these are a people that the Earthers and Mars to a large extent also have kept them poor for 100 years. Like, there's enough abundance on Earth and there's enough wealth and technology on Mars that everyone could live better lives.
And the Belt is sort of living like, and they talk about that in the earlier seasons, but it's sort of like a secondary storyline of the Belt being like the wants to get in the mix, because like the big storyline of the earlier seasons is Mars and Earth pointing guns at each other, and they're, you know, there's this new weapon that none of them can control that's causing political turmoil. That's and the Belt has always been like the, hey, we want a piece of this too, don't forget about us. And you sort of see the growth of the Belt through Fred Johnson and Anderson Dawes and the OPA and all that's happening slowly, but it was sort of like definitely the C plot, you know, it was not the AB, you know, plot.
The authors and the creators of this universe have done their homework in history, right? Because in the first couple episodes of the show and the first book, It is class warfare and it's control of resources, right?
Yeah.
The Belters are 100% dependent upon they are not in control of the air and the water.
Yes.
That is required to be alive. And the food, right? All of the food comes from down the well, or a vast majority of the food comes from Earth, right? And so when you are dependent on that, and you're dependent on the Earth, it is so like easy for resentments to build up, especially if the Earth throws its weight around, or the Earth doesn't have to think about it. Right? They are not a consideration in terms of decision making for the belters, right? And so they get it so right that this is a resource allocation and control problem. Mm-hmm. And that's the genius of these books is that they have a compelling case about, you know, how they've been treated. They have a compelling perspective. Mm-hmm. Inaros, that's his genius, right? Demagogues tap into perceived or real slights, perceived real fear, perceived or real absence or the threat of losing power, right? What little power they have. And so he's tapped into all of that. It's so smart. And you can't just dismiss them as villains, straight up villains. You just can't do it. Now you can. Inaros is a villain because he has killed millions of human beings on Earth now. I mean, as the result of sending those stealth tech asteroids.
Well, that's a secondary conversation.
The Earth.
We're up here. Let's this is the state of things right now. The Rosinante is on.
Talk about the really smart. I love how they did this in the book. Really well done in the show to break up the crew.
Yes,
like that's an unheard of choice in shows like this. Right. You broke up the crew.
There's all these storylines, and there's basically let's go through each storyline going on right now. Holden is on Tycho Station with Fred Johnson getting the Rosinante patched up after what happened in season four. It's all beat up, and they're hanging out. Amos is going to Earth. Alex is going to Mars to check on his family. They're having like a moment of like, let's take a break. I got to sort some stuff out. And then Naomi is going to go track down her kid. She gets word that where her kid is. So she's going to try to track him down. What other storyline? She's on the moon. And that's pretty much the story.
Last season she lost the Secretary General election, so she is no longer Secretary General. It's not clear to me exactly what her role is.
She's administrator or like
special envoy or something.
She's administrating the refugees going to the ring. Like she's part of that UN effort.
But she's
marginalized. She's marginalized.
Absolutely.
And she's been pushed off to the moon.
Right.
She's not even on Earth anymore when all this stuff happens. And that's like kind of like it looks like it sucks, but it's a good thing she's not on Earth. After what happens at the end of episode 3.
She chooses
three.
It. Remember the last season, she made the choice to go to the moon. And that is tension between her and her significant other, right?
Her husband. I feel like you have to watch every episode and remember everything because there's so much going on in the show.
Yeah, after she loses the election, he has the moment where it's like, you lost. It's time to retire. It's time for the quiet life. And she can't give it up. Yeah. Even to be on the furthest frayed edge of being in power, she can't not try to be involved somehow.
She correctly sees that the protomolecule and everything that results from all of that is an existential threat, right? So she's got a, and the opening of the ring gates are an existential threat to humanity.
100%. But so far they haven't talked much about the ring gates. But the ring gates have really impacted Mars. The idea of Martians building up Mars because this is our planet, but then suddenly you're adding all these other planets that have oxygen and food and resources that you could just leave and you don't have to terraform, you don't have to do anything to. So Mars starts to get fractured. But this is what starts to lead to Marco Inaros's power, which is this writing is so good because you start to see with the steps that it takes.
That's also it all fits together.
Yeah,
also Marco Inaros's genius is he senses that this is the perfect time to execute this plot. all these moving parts. And you're absolutely, you hit it right in the head, Patrick, that the catalyst really, I mean, the ring gates and those being open and the Society of Mars having, they were truly like a Spartan focused existence. They were focused on A, establishing a powerful, not Earth-like society. Like they didn't, they were not going to be fat and bloated and dependent on, you know, whatever they envision Earth to be. They were going to be lean and focused, and they were going to terraform Mars and turn it into a new Earth.
And they
were
all like super smart, and they had like great technology because all the people that would go to Mars would be like scientists and and astronauts and intelligent people and
yeah, engineers,
engineers.
Well, and you said it too, because the terraforming of Mars was going to take generations. Like your great grandkids were the ones who are going to inherit hopefully a lush green planet. And now, because of the ring gates, you can leave Mars with the kids that you have. You go to it, it'll take you a year or two, and you can create a new society on a planet where you don't have to reconstruct Earth itself. You can instantaneously have the paradise
oxygen and
always
food
wanted.
And build up a life for yourself on that planet. And
so that singular focused society.
It's an interesting
idea,
right?
It's a fantastic idea.
It's fractured. And we see this like just in one shot, really, where Alex comes to Mars. He's walking through the streets and he looks up and you see all the businesses closing, all the apartments for rent. And then Bobby is in a bad place. The bars are half empty. Like no one's there, and Bobby's in a bad place, and you find out what Bobby's doing is she's trying to track down these weapons sales, but you don't know who they're selling to yet. This is early on in 1, 2, 3, and you find he gets involved with her and all this stuff. They go in the Razorback to try to track down what's happening. While this is happening, asteroid hits. Multiple asteroids. The president of Earth gets killed. Tons of people dying everywhere. Amos is on Earth tracking down stuff with the woman that he dies. But then he goes to visit Clarissa Mao. He's trapped in a prison cell with all this
so
going on. It's so good. Like all of the Amos stuff. So here's the brilliance of this show is like Amos is like amazing. And he's like, he just murders fools left and right. But then the end of the episode, he like, they had to murder that guy who was hunkered down. This is the episode. Sorry, I'm skipping ahead to episode 6.
Yeah, that's survivalism.
Yeah, survivalism. He murders that guy. Clarissa and him murder the guy.
Well, Clarissa does.
Yes. And Amos doesn't even like think twice about it. And then she points out that like, we're broken, like something's wrong with us, that we're like, okay, just killing this dude. And then he says, I got to get back to my crew. And then it sent chills through my spine of like, oh shit. Like these guys are all spread out and they all make each other better. And it's, that's the glory of the show is like these four people were banded together and put in this position to help people through Holden, and none of them would have survived without them all being there.
Yeah.
And sort of, and now they're all spread out and chaos is happening through the system. And like Holden almost dies. Like Naomi barely saves him from like starting up the ship. There's crazy, like, so it's sort of this interesting idea of like, they all need each other because they're all just fractured.
Definitely the idea of, I mean, the found family idea, right? That exists. I mean, and it's perfect. It's almost perfectly realized in The Expanse of they are absolutely greater than the sum of their parts.
Right.
For the crew of the Rosinante are absolutely greater than the sum of their parts. And what makes Amos such a compelling character to, you know, experience is he has things that he wants and he has people that he wants to keep safe. And if anything threatens that, he is comfortable doing anything to ensure that his people are safe and that he gets what he wants. He will do anything and feel no guilt.
No.
The line that you got to at the end of this episode, Patrick, it gave me chills too, and because Amos understands that about himself. He understands that he is capable of anything, any kind of violence, any kind of...
He does what needs to be done. He does,
but it's...
To survive.
For the survival moment. That's exactly right.
Yeah. But he understands...
That's the prime directive for him.
Like, right, Holden would hold him back.
He knows that he needs to be kept in check. He knows that about himself. He's like, I will do whatever I need to do, but... Some of the stuff I'm willing to do, I know I shouldn't.
Yes.
So I have to have someone who will stop me.
Yes. And Naomi in the first few seasons and as soon as he starts trusting Holden becomes that rock eventually. It's just like you're making me want to watch like season one through four.
Amos has this wonderful, I think he's one of my favorite current and maybe of all time.
They're all interesting in different ways.
Characters.
Like, yeah.
But Amos is an amazing, he has this clarity that is enviable, right? I mean, I envy him in his clarity, and he has this amoral pragmatism about his approach to life and his life. And he has a code, but it is straight up like, the pragmatism is I got to survive, and the people that are in my circle are going to survive, and whatever it takes, regardless of what it is, I'm going to do it in order. That's simple. That's clarity. And he needs some of that external moral guidance because I love the window into his life and what he had to do to survive to get to where he is really great.
Really interesting episodes.
You get it a lot more in the books, but the show has done a nice job of just a little teasers about, oh my God, this guy, what a life he led, right?
Mm-hmm, to talk about the effectiveness of the storytelling of the show for a second, we fill in all those blanks for in Amos's background. Like, we know he grew up rough. He didn't have a mother. He had a person who took care of him.
But we don't really know any specifics from this.
Exactly. We don't know like exactly what he's done. We don't know exactly what he's had to do.
Who he really is. Like we're learning more about that this season than ever before.
Amos writing this year, the writing specifically and how they're characterizing him and portraying him is the best out of all of like our main protagonists.
Yeah.
How they're establishing who he is and how he became the way he is the best writing of the series so far, in my opinion. Totally. It's been just great to see that and to experience that. And it makes me, want to read the books again so we can get even more detail on that.
Yeah,
but I like how they're telling his story because they're letting the audience fill in the blanks for what he would have to learn to be to survive in this world. And now we're in a place where he is uniquely equipped to survive a non-civilized world.
Yeah.
And he's realized that about himself, and he knows how dangerous he is. And he said it. I mean, like, you know, civilization keeps people civil. Mm-hmm. Amos is not a civil guy.
Yeah.
Amos will, if you cross him or cross people that he cares about, he'll shoot you. And sleep soundly that night. That's who he is.
It's pretty interesting. He's willing to just like do whatever it takes to do whatever he wants. Like, but it's like he's not just like straight murdering people.
He's not an anarchist. That's the difference. Right. It's not anarchy.
Yeah, it's not anarchy. Yeah. It's like he when he sees injustice, he just does whatever he wants to.
Well, as he defines it, right? Yes, again, it's all about his.
Moral
very guy. Simple, very simple code, you know?
You're saying I really enjoy that storyline, but the storyline with Alex and Bobby has been really interesting this season two, and like what's going on Mars and like them trying to track this stuff down. And what how it's affecting Bobby, I think, is really interesting, because at first I didn't know why she was so pissed. But then you start to realize that, like, the idea of Mars is gone.
Yeah.
And she's
Mars is dead.
And she's not okay with this. And yeah. But she still feels like she's a Martian, and she has to do what she can to sort it out and make sure, like, she has some sort of duty, and she can't be a soldier anymore. She can't be a Martian Marine anymore. And so she's still working for Arvasala. I'm terrible at saying that name. Sorry. But,
let's just call her the old lady.
The old lady.
Working for the old lady.
Avasarala. Avasarala.
Avasarala.
Avasarala.
So she's still working.
It took me forever. I had to teach myself how to say it.
Yes. It's tough.
Yeah.
She's still working for her to sort out what's going on, because, like, you know, she's just an agent of the old lady. And it's sort of that whole storyline is kind of like, oh, she's realizing that the Belters are buying Martian tech. The Belters are running around in warships because Mars is defunct. Mars's military is screwed. And they're running around in Martian Navy warships. And when you think about that, that's crazy to think about, like, this terrorist organization having this nuclear weapons and giant rockets to just blast people out of the sky, because the Martian Navy was very powerful and
they've got by far the best. That was the conceit. That was the main image of Mars, is that they're a smaller society than Earth, but they're much more kind of forward thinking in their tech. They're much more advanced.
Their military might was more advanced than,
and that exactly. was sort of that was the crutch of, like, the first few seasons, is like, Earth has a bigger force, but we don't want to fight with these guys because it's going to be rough. They could smoke us, you know, and this sort of mutually assured destruction that was going on in the first few seasons. But it's this interest. I really like where the season's going. I think season four was, like, interesting. And you guys talked about how that book was the most boring because none of it was happening in the belt.
I don't know if I would call it boring. It was the most difficult to get through.
Okay.
There's a difference between being boring and difficult to get through, just because I respect the story that they were trying to tell being on that planet.
Yeah.
Like, I get the themes that they were going for, but because it was such a wild departure from what we had with the initial trilogy mm-hmm. of books, that made it more difficult for me to get through than the first three books.
Well, the complicated, like, perspectives and being all over the place, and this interesting jump around of, like, what does this mean? This happened. What does this mean? Uh-oh, we just lost Andrew. Did his thing? Uh-oh. Oh.
Crept out. Oh.
I think his laptop went to sleep.
Andrew, change those settings. What do you say?
Okay. Yeah. So, very interesting season. Let me go through my notes real quick and make sure that I didn't miss anything that we should talk about. I think it's kind of interesting what's going on with, like, Naomi on that ship. They're keeping her alive.
Yeah, we really talked about that whole relationship and her sort of storyline. It's the least dynamic of any of the storylines because she's immediately captured. Mm. And it's a lot of talky-talky, right?
A lot of it. Well, she tries to kill. She's going to kill Marco, and then Philip stopped her.
Right.
Philip
clearly feels for her, and Philip is clearly, like, challenged by the tension between mm-hmm. he wants to sort of do right and follow his father's lead, but he also has love for his mother. She clearly you know, he's impressed by and touched by the fact that she tried to find him, and she did find him. And so he's torn by that. You can see that. It's a nice job by the actor. You can clearly see that tension happening, right? And so,
yeah.
Well, she's creating tension, a lot of tension on that ship. Like, Marco is doing all this other stuff, and behind him, it's his old fling with who's the mother of his kid, who like hasn't questioned his judgment or his say up until this point, and then some of his crew members who like her and remember her also not liking like what Marco plans to just like space her, you know. It's just, yeah, like, no, we can't just space her. Like, what, like this is not okay. She's a Belter too. It's sort of this interesting dynamic. And is Naomi going to be like the downfall of Marco and Aros? That's sort of like where my brain starts to go, is when it comes to Philip choosing the mother or Marco, is what's gonna, like, if he's got a gun in his hand, he's got to shoot one of them. Like, I don't know what.
You got to finish reading the books, dude. It is freaking bonkers where it goes.
It really
seriously.
Like, are we going to get that answer in this season, or is that okay? Okay.
Or yes. Great. Or no.
They haven't. Yes. I mean, they've pulled other storylines into different seasons at different times. They haven't strictly stayed with the books through. They pulled Bobby into the storyline way earlier than she starts to appear.
Yeah.
In the books. And Avasarala as well. You barely get a sense of her in the first book, and she's all over the second book, but she's in the very first episode of the series. So where they go, and yeah
man, you got to read the books, because that storyline is incredible, and you need to read them. I strongly encourage everyone to read them.
It's really kind of interesting. I had a couple of other things. It's interesting. I thought it was interesting that the stealth technology that they use in the asteroids they've gotten from Mars, like we talked about them getting the ships from them, but the stealth technology was from Mars also. So that's like this interesting, like, it, once
Earth, it's like this paint. They painted the asteroids.
Yeah, right.
Facing Earth. So they couldn't be detected by the Watchtower satellites.
Very interesting, because you'd think that like Earth would have these satellites to keep an eye on rockets or asteroids, they do. And so it's this like complicated, like the belt buying all this like old Martian tech, these bombs and just stealth tech on asteroids, a very low tech, very high tech, very low tech, weapon. What else did I have? Proto model, like Fred Johnson dies. We didn't talk about that at all. Fred Johnson dies. He had the proto molecule. Dude,
so much going on that we.
There's so
we,
much going I mean, on. That's why I took notes. That's why I'm looking at my notes. So Fred Johnson dies. He had the proto molecule. They leave Holden alive at that moment. She shoots Fred in the back. She
again, an agent of Marco Inaris.
Yeah.
Who is working at Tycho Station, again, working on the Rosinante. She is Marco's agent, among others, on Tycho stations.
Very interesting, like, giant robot spider thing comes in, takes the protomolecule.
Some really interesting. I mean,
that was cool.
Some fun set pieces this season.
Yeah,
With all of that, like, they've ratcheted that up a little bit. I mean, they had fun. They always have fun set pieces in the Expanse, just because the technology. I mean, the technology is like as grounded in real kind of conceptual science fiction as you can get.
Yeah.
But the way they pull it off, it just feels so good and feels so real. But
so
it's like
real.
200 years in the future, real.
Right.
You
know,
it's like you feel like, okay, this totally makes sense, and this is totally awesome.
Totally makes sense.
Yeah, yep, and totally awesome. Like the most recent episode, I'm not spoiling anything when I say that absolutely ridiculously awesome moment when Bobby just goes ham on those pirates that are trying to take him down, and she's in her Goliath, you know, recon armor,
yeah,
and her and her Alex, armor, yeah, you know, take out that crew. That yeah. was just so, it's so fun. It's so fun to watch, like, awesome science fiction action.
Realistic.
Totally realistic.
You know, yes. Check out, I called it when episode, like, one, when Chekhov's gun, when she shows the power armor, like, that she was able to buy on the black market.
See, and I've forgotten that. I was like,
she's going to end up wearing that. She's going to murder some fools. Like,
absolutely.
That absolutely has to happen. Like,
absolutely.
They showed the gun on the mantelpiece. It had to fire.
It's that shit was that was a really that kind of, and they pull that stuff off so well on The Expanse. It's just like that level of quality.
Yep.
Cinematic television that not a lot of people can pull off right now, and it's just really
well
fun
and then we
beyond
I mean,
everything
we,
else
we were like we were what do they call it when you like can't wait to watch an episode, like I was doing that with The Mandalorian, where it's like, okay,
anticipation,
it's like, no, there's a name for it, it's like I don't know. I'll think of it. But
okay.
It's like you're waiting until the episode comes, and then you're just like, you watch it immediately as soon as you're able to, you know, must see television kind of a thing. And I feel that about this show. Like I felt that about The Mandalorian. I could not wait to watch the episodes. I was, you know, as soon as I was able to, I watched them. I'm doing that with this one. Let's see what else. Oh yeah, Drummer, she's being a pirate, and there's sort of this interesting idea that they talk about where all the belt needs to come together, even if they have differences. Like, she doesn't agree with she has like three
mass
ships.
Murder.
Mass murder.
She doesn't agree with mass murder.
Well, and
but,
she has a personal reaction to Marco in the sense that the the actor's name is David Strathairn.
Hold on, I got it written down. What's his name? Ashford.
Inaros killed Ashford and now has killed Fred. And
I loved Ashford. I loved
Ashford. Ashford was great. And now, I mean, Drummer is like the two men in the world that I respected probably the most. You have killed them. And you're doing this shit that endangers the belt and directly contradicts what I have believed was the good path the belt was on following these men, or for the most part, you know, it's personal for her. And you do not want to fuck with Kamina Drummer.
She's a great character. Yeah.
That is the worst person in the world to make your enemy, because she is so driven,
her
so focused,
and she's willing to murder you if need be. Like, she's like Amos in that way, where it's like she has a code of conduct too, and she's done some stuff in the past, and she's willing. I mean, that's the thing, is you start to see that she's like kind of good in this season. Where, like, she doesn't leave.
I think we got to move beyond, like, the traditional.
Yeah.
We got to move beyond the traditional definitions of good and evil.
I play Dungeons and Dragons, man. I know that
everybody.
I know the alignments.
I got you, but everybody has their own codes, and everybody has what they want and what they're willing to do to get it. And Marco has a code, and he has what he wants, and he's willing to murder people. Everyone in his mind is guilty except his people, the belt. Everyone else is guilty. So he's willing to do anything to achieve his ends because he is convinced of his own righteousness. Absolutely convinced, which makes him delusional, but also very, very dangerous. So it's all these competing ideals. If there's been any, and I'm sure we'll get into it because, you know, we saw flashes of Holden being his truly kind of heroic self in the first couple episodes, but now that he is on the hunt, we're gonna Holden and his code and his what he wants is gonna come up against, you know, because he's like the most, I think, traditionally heroic character in the show. Mm-hmm. So now that he's off of Tycho and he's running to find Marcos, we'll get into kind of where Holden's going to come down and what he's going to have to compromise. Because there's always got to be a compromise, right? Holden will have to give in on something that he feels is like an essential of his, you know, what will he have to do that he'll put a bad taste in his mouth?
Holden is the Malcolm Reynolds of this. He's willing to do what's right. Forget the law. Like, just do it. Like, he's neutral good if you're D&D, you know, it's sort of like, he doesn't care what it takes. It's just he's going to be good and do the right thing. Where do we leave him in this episode? Like, I feel like he was still on Tycho. He hasn't left yet. Did they leave?
No, the Rocinante leaves Tycho.
Okay,
in the episode.
Yeah, and then
they fixed the engine. There was bad code in the engine. Naomi saves them, right? She gets a message out to him. And then they fix that, and then they leave Tycho too.
And the old lady gets approached by the new leader of the UN to help him out. So she's back in the power mix.
Right.
Because this guy who's been thrust out.
He's like
the Secretary
of Agriculture or something.
Yeah.
Out of his depth.
Yeah.
Reminded me a lot of Battlestar Galactica.
Absolutely. That's
yes. The president, the cabinet members all die in the Cylons attacking, and then the Secretary of Education is put in charge. She definitely rises to the occasion.
Laura Roslin becomes the most impressive character in the show, basically.
So I had definitely Battlestar flashbacks on that.
Absolutely.
But she's back. Amos is still on Earth. Alex and Bobby, what are they doing? Where do we leave off?
They got away from that pirate crew
by dumping their core, right? So they are currently adrift.
No, but they were able to start their engine.
Oh yeah, no, they were found by that drifter ship.
No, but then they had the gunfight and they blew up that ship and they flew off. Were they able
to fire up the ship?
They were able to fire up. I don't know how they were able to do that.
Interesting.
They were able to start up their ship again, but
I need to watch that episode again.
Well, yeah, he was like pancaked on the floor. Remember, he's pancaked.
Yeah,
on the floor.
Right.
So they were shooting off.
They were high G acceleration away because they blew that ship up.
Yeah, so I don't know where they're headed. I think that was the last thing that we saw with them.
Mm-hmm.
Naomi's in a cell. Philip is talking to her, but she's trapped on the ship. She has less. They're going to end up like killing her or doing something, or they won't kill her, but like something's going to happen. Obviously, like she's
no one is guaranteed. I'll say that, Patrick.
Nope.
Oh God. Yeah, that's pretty much like where the episode six ends, and we'll find
past
out what
the midpoint of the season. There's four episodes left.
Uh-huh.
So they've got lots of ways
What a great season though. Like, I was so excited when the first three episodes came back. I watched them like back to back, and just a really interesting setup for the show. I'm just happy it didn't get canceled by Sci-Fi, you know.
Well, I mean,
one more season, right?
Yeah, and then season after this one, which makes sense to me because where the books have gone, the 7, 8, and 9, the book series is going to be 9 books.
Those storylines could be compressed. I think
absolutely. That's what I think. Like you have the first trilogy that establishes the ring gates, and then you have the second trilogy that kind of gives context to where humanity is going to go now that the ring gates are open. And then the third trilogy goes in a totally different direction.
It builds on the first two.
It does.
It's not a totally different direction. It absolutely, again, the thread through everything is the protomolecule. They have to bring that home. And the final trilogy is very focused on.
Yes.
Protomolecule is the disruptor of humanity in the galaxy and now beyond the galaxy.
Well,
What does it do to forever transform the human race?
Well, they touch on it for a second in the first six episodes. It's a conversation between Fred and Holden where he was like, every time I go through the gate, I saw them. I saw the people who killed the other people that we haven't met yet, the flashes. And every time I go through, they're not happy. And he's thinking that they can sense when other ships are going through, and we're waking them up. That's what he says. We're waking them up. And that doesn't seem good. That doesn't seem good.
It's probably not good.
It's not good.
Yeah, no, it's a bad thing.
Spoiler, that's a bad thing.
Not good.
Okay. So I think that's good, that's pretty much all my notes, unless you guys had something else.
No, we covered a lot.
We covered a lot. There was a lot. Thank you for sticking through our first six episodes. Andrew, do you have any trivia for us?
I do. Excellent. It is appropriately Expanse themed.
Great.
Chris might have an easier time of this than Patrick.
Oh, God.
So they've announced the title of the ninth book.
Oh.
And I don't know if you guys know this, but there are eight books that are currently published. What are the book's titles? Expanse books titles. What are they? In no particular order, but there's eight of them that are out. Give me the eight titles.
Leviathan Wakes. Caliban's War. Something like that.
Okay, that's two.
That's all I got.
Abaddon's Gate.
Abaddon's Gate.
That's three.
Cibola Burn.
Cibola Burn. Yeah.
Cibola Burn.
Yeah.
Ooh.
So basically, by name,
book eight was Tiamat's Wrath. I'm working backwards now.
Yes.
Yeah. Book seven was Persepolis Rising.
Rising. Yeah, that sounds right.
So you got two left.
Two left.
You guys have been correct on all of them so far.
Nice.
And the season that we are in directly coincides with the two books that are left.
God damn it!
I know, right? I had to look this up. I didn't remember these titles when I was looking at this.
I'm blanking on... That's books five and six, right? I'm blanking on those. Yeah.
Yep. But watching this season reminded me just how good those books are.
How good they are. Dude, you're making me want to just watch, like, all the
I need to start from the beginning and work my
That's
way
what
through.
I'm saying. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. I think that I'll... Maybe this week.
Yeah, what are those titles? I don't know, Andrew.
Okay, so book one, Leviathan Wakes. Book two, Caliban's War. Book three, Abaddon's Gate. Book four, Cibola Burn. Book five, Nemesis Games.
Nemesis Games.
Book six, Babylon's Ashes.
Yes, all right.
Book seven, Persepolis Rising. Book eight is Tiamat's Wrath. And the ninth book, the one coming later this year, the final book in the Expanse series, Leviathan Falls.
Oh.
Yeah. Right?
Oh. That sounds awesome.
That sure sounds crazy.
So that's my trivia. Good job, boys. I mean, you got six out of eight. Pretty damn good.
Good job, Andrew. Good job, Christopher. If you'd like to help Andrew with his trivia, you should email him at kingofthenorth52@gmail.com. Email the podcast, brothersgeekpodcast@gmail.com, brothers_geek on twitter.com, Brothers Geek Podcast on Facebook, brothersgeek.com, Brothers Geek Do Stuff on Instagram. Pretty much it.
Wear a mask, be a hero.
And